sociology and religion. So in that context, I'm going to talk today about this topic here. I should also say, in the background, that I did my master's at Hamilton Christian University and have been one of those heart-carrying members of the Church of Christ going back to early generations, several generations on both sides of my family. So it's been a pleasure to be here this week, and I want to raise the question that you see here and talk about it in a variety of ways. But before I do that, I want to say something about this particular lectureship program in women. As I went through the book, the program book, I counted over 40 sessions that were either involving the topic of women in religion, either women teaching on something related to the Bible, or speaking in the capacity that Sarah did yesterday, or the extra session on women talking about the book, Finding Their Voices, that I hope all of you have seen by now, because it's in my church sermons. Lots of things going on. This story doesn't count the number of women who are involved in leading worship early in the morning, or it doesn't count the number of women who may be hosting this or that, but it is safe to say that at this conference, there are a lot of women involved. And the notion of this lectureship being open to the conversation about women's role in the church is certainly one that is alive and real. We also know, most of us know, that that may not be the case everywhere, that there are churches on the other end of what we're seeing here, where there's an understanding about the fixed role that women have. It's very much the same role that they did have a number of years ago, but there are no discussions going on. And then in between, there are lots of different churches as well. So if we're characterizing things, we have to say there's a continuum. And on that continuum, there are a number of churches on moving toward one end, moving toward more involvement on the part of women, and a number of who are not choosing to be involved in the conversation, and in this middle group. But I want to go back to the question, is there a link between submission at home and submission at church? How does woman's space get negotiated in both home and church? This particular topic is new to me, and I'm going to give you, at least the first part of this, is a more academic presentation of some things than what I normally do in a church setting. It comes out of a question that I've asked myself over many years, and that is the question of why is it that some women in churches of Christ are very interested in more involvement and public involvement, and other women are not. You know what I'm talking about? That it's an interesting question. I think it's a question where we have an answer, they're answering honestly. Some are very interested, some are not. So what's the key to that? As I begin to explore that, I'm not sure that a lot of what I have to say today will address that directly, but I hope about the thing between the two. I would suggest it's important for two reasons. One, because in addition to biblical study, I think we can learn from cultural trends some things that may help clarify our understanding. That I think it may help to clarify our understanding of issues. If we know something about how the space is negotiated, it may help us say, yes, I can see that. I can see how this may be a factor. And then the second reason I think it's an important question is because we have a long way to go as we try to continue to work through women's goals. Education matters, and there is room for progress. Currently, we are a movement that is not completely egalitarian in our public culture, and I think we will all benefit from your study. Again, we have some excellent biblical studies that are going on, and hopefully, with some of the Kinsey Gossi sessions and others this week, I just can, because I was in a conversation with him last night. So back to the ethnographies. There are ethnographies about evangelical women. Now, I don't consider the Churches of Christ to be evangelical in many ways, but I think the evangelical positions and sessions about women are somewhat parallel to those in the Churches of Christ. And the reason I use those also there's not that many done by Church of Christ congregations that we can look at. So it's important to look at what it is that moving right along. The two ethnographical studies, in case you'd like to look at these at some point in the future, is Stella Tom's The Women in Submission, Evangelical Women in the Association of Patriarchy in South Korea. And then Arnold Griffith's book, God's Waters, Evangelical Women and Power, is sufficient. And then the third one, Alec Hedges' book, is Christ in the History of the Church, a biblical understanding of leadership and Christian. Some of you may not be familiar with what an ethnography is. And let me say that the best way to talk about an ethnography is lots of ethnographies being done today. But it's basically an attempt to talk about lived religion. It requires the person who's writing the book to be an excellent researcher and a participant on the ground with the people that he or she studies. So they would be doing interviews. They would be looking at the materials that are printed. They would be looking at the history of a given group. But I think the best way to understand a particular religious group, what's going on in the congregation, if it's available, to look at what's going on the ground. What is it that they are believing? What is it they are acting out? What is it that they think is the meaning behind various doctrines in the church? And again, that's what always we call lived religion, which is if you want to know what's really going on, talk to the people who are living this what they say. So this first ethnography about evangelical women in South Korea, is a good place to look, an interesting place to look. Tom Gifford worked in the late 1990s. South Korea, with the entire population, is about 22% evangelical today. That's the highest concentration of evangelicals in the Asian world. In the United States, it's about 27-29%. So, yes, there's a gap, but a good number of evangelicals exist in South Korea. The pictures that I've chosen here are one of them. The first one is the picture of a large church outside Seoul. The largest evangelical church in South Korea since they had 350,000 members. So we're talking about huge numbers of people. This one, though, is smaller. But you can see that they're very interested in modern architecture. And so the church is built in a way that they think is very accommodating to the latest things that people need, like we build maybe a baseball city in the United States. So in the second picture shows what looks like a typical church building. The churches that Tom worked with, one was an evangelical Presbyterian and one was an evangelical Methodist church. She conducted over 100 interviews with well-educated middle-class women who claimed an affiliation with one of these churches. And each one had about 8 to 10,000 members. They both practice an understanding that women's role is one of submission to men. And one of the interesting things about South Korea, just to give you a little historical context, that South Korea had a good number of rights for women prior to the 1400s, which was when Neo-Confucianism comes in. And at that point, the subjugation of women was enforced and created a very high restrictions and limitations on them, including limited education. Literacy was unknown to them. One of the most interesting things that's carried on, though, is that even though a lot of that is not true today, one thing that continues to be true is that young brides marry and move into the home of their husband's parents. Well, the mother moves in with them, whichever the case may be, that they have a close relationship with the mother-in-law once they move. And in this arrangement, the mother-in-law is given a lot of control over the new daughter-in-law. And in fact, according to Tom, the two primary functions of the daughter-in-law is to produce sons and to produce and provide domestic labor. And the woman, the new bride's best hope, is if she produces a son, then someday when her son grows up and gets married, then she will get a servant to work with her, right? So that's going on, and modernization has caused, I think the millennials are really challenging this in South Korea. But if you talk to women who were born in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, that's still a lot of labor experience. And Paul's main question was, why do women who live in a somewhat patriarchal culture and who are expected to submit to their husbands at home choose to join a religious group in which they may or must practice submission? Why do they do that? Which kind of gets back to the first question I raised early on. On the one hand, women reported freedom in Christ. On the other hand, the church preached the traditional directives that wives would submit to husbands in home, elsewhere, and follow the church resources. Tom's study led her to conclude that women in South Korea wanted a relational faith, and they found peace in the masculine God, who often seemed to take the place of a father or a husband. A masculine deity, what did he do for them? He loved her unconditionally. He loved her unconditionally. And then they somehow, Paul says, somehow they accepted the paradox. They accepted the contradictions. Yes, there was still male authority and limited limits on what they could do. However, they were empowered because they had opportunities to get out of their home. And in addition to that, their church work, where they could read Bible studies with other women, pray with other women, provided them with a certain amount of prestige. And so they were negotiating this power in the church in ways that were beneficial to them. The church also constantly told them that they were responsible for disharmony. When they wanted harmony in their households, they must give up their egoism and their haughtiness and their patience by submitting to their husbands. So underneath their obedience, and the Kickstarter deserves as a given to improve that. Talk us all about that paradox as complicated as a kind of dance that the women are doing. She said they were simultaneously leading lives of deliverance and submission, lives where they were constantly negotiating between the constraints and the freedom of the cross. And thus, the title of her book, Deliverance and Submission. This negotiated space required that they continue to submit, however, that they feel less angry and more capable because of what the church had called. And the church served to empower them while at the same time reinforcing the cultural neo-confusion ideas. Now, this case study raises several questions. One is, how much is the South Korean story culturally specific to South Korea? How much is reflecting an evangelical culture that is actually cross culture? And a third way is that some suggest that perhaps it's reflected a culture similar to that in the United States. And if so, what does that mean? Now, I put a moment in all of that, but I'll make one comment about the 1950s. In this one way, it does seem that in the 1950s and 60s, there were a lot of angry women in the United States. And those women sometimes reported that they were feeling trapped, that they felt like their beautiful suburban homes were the latest appliances, were not meeting their needs, and they wanted something more. They didn't feel like their life was meaningful. That domestic kind of life was one that they were wanting out of. Some women chose to go to work at that particular time. But if you look at women's Bible studies, they were often made up in that time period, if you look back at some of the literature of evangelicals, that expressed that felt good expressions of women who were very angry. And then as you trace that forward, you see there's a fluidity. So that there was fewer women in that age group to be angry, and others were not so angry. So you have a kind of fluidity in the women's groups who were reading, studying the Bible, praying together in the United States. So you might have extremely angry women on one end, and women who were totally embracing the book, The Total Woman, the beginning of your further that book, on the other end. So this was negotiated. This is the point here. South Korea is still negotiating this. The United States negotiated it. You can't make the conclusion that perhaps what's going on in South Korea today may be similar to what's going on here in the 1950s. But I think it's clear that regardless, there is a sense in which fluidity is happening. Now we're going to go on to the second part, which is, this next study, God's Daughter to Evangelical Women, the Power of Submission, is about the Women's World Fellowship. It's mainly Assembly of God, Charismatic. It's now been called, it's now called Globe International. It's one of the largest women's religious organizations in the world. It started in 1967 with 4 members. It exists in 170 nations today. In the United States, it's primarily white and middle class. And her particular work was also done in the Pacific in the mid-90s. And again, she worked over extensive field work and included not only attending the meetings, but reading a lot of material that was published. Continue to promote additional States, you can see some similarities in South Korea. Some scholars have suggested that there is a strong therapeutic culture in the local organizations. God can change things, God can change the name of the women they feel. And the other thing that comes out from this study is the power of submission. I want to tell you a little bit of what she finds from the studying and reading the world literature. That in the early period, from the 60s and 70s, the women were encouraged to submit to their husbands, even when husbands were abusive. And they were encouraged to take it, because that was what they believed God wanted them to do. And in 1974, there was a Bible study book published by a local woman called God's Daughter. It went through 14 printings. And one of the points made in the booklet was that women received a benefit from submission, which was they got protection from their husbands. And so submission was a way that they were free to do some things that they were protected. I want to give you the analogy that stuck out to her, and I think it's a very important one. She said, in a booklet, a train is being run on track. As long as the train stays on its track, it's free to fulfill that for which it was made. When it jumps the track, chaos results. Second, lately, you guys see the importance of that, a certain understanding of women, maybe in the past, but certainly one that we may have heard. The woman concluded that women should not try to emulate the role reversal so often called for by society, that they should stick with their roles as homemakers. And in 1974, that was assessed. However, by 1985, that chapter in that book was revised. And at this point, in 85, the book started talking about Jesus' submission to God. And there wasn't much said about gender submission at all. In fact, the author said, submission to our husbands is not made to second-class citizens or those who are ranked below the totem pole, as less of beings than of us. We have a side-by-side relationship. So even though gender roles are still fought in some ways, it was fought more in the context of mutual submission. So they too were in transition. The woman's goal in the family is that she wanted to create an ideal Christian family, transform home life. And throughout their study, prayer and obedience to Jesus possible has been the key motivator. And for the women who have been in the world, they will be connected to what to huge benefits to them and their family life. Now, Ruth mentions work. And she says that by the 1990s, you begin to get work being a part of the world literature. And at work point in the 1990s, there was even a tendency to lie about what a model career woman might look like. And this was necessary because there were so many women going into the workforce. The global organization adapted to the changing culture, one of which economics became important. So the somewhat common assumption emerged that a family was stronger, a family unit was stronger, it would be financially stronger, or if there was financial stability. Right? If you could guarantee that, then that would be a good thing. And so the idea in the world was that Christian womanhood still involved male compliance. But there was some unfulfilling uncertainties that women weren't always proud of, but they were willing to talk about. And they began to begin. Their interest in work began to be more of a focus. So what did this study, or what might this study, have to say to Church of Christ? If you look at me, many sociological studies that have talked about the effects of women going to work in our society. Whenever we think of culture, there are different institutions. There's a home, a public square, the activities outside the home, including workplace, and the church. And this slide is really getting to the heart of this presentation. Submission at home seems to be a foundation to understanding submission in church. We understand something about how that's been working out in the second half of the 20th century in evangelical homes. We may understand more about how it works out in Church of Christ as well. In the late 19th century, there were few women who worked outside the home. But that changed. In the early 20th century, you begin to read about the first women who go into medicine. For law and journalism. And But by the second half of the 20th century, large numbers of women were pursuing professional careers, and by the 1980s, large numbers of evangelical women were working. This meant that women's space in the home and in the work world, in the public sphere, had to be renegotiated. Now, I've done some work, I haven't looked at every copy, but I've looked at some copies of the Gospel Advocate, which is a magazine, a journal, that tells us something about what some of our ministers are thinking at various times in our own district. And in the 70s and 80s, I've seen some comments made by some preachers that were not positive for women working. And you probably seen those and we've heard about those. There have been some churches that have made an issue of it in some ways. But is it a fairly quiet issue maybe over the last 20 years? And it was never one that was divisive, as far as I know, to the church. And now, in 2015, it seems somewhat accepted that women and men can both go to work if they want to. I have the same premise used in the early 1950s that it was good for families to have a kind of strong financial base. But the interesting thing is, it's become a matter of negotiation between the woman and her husband. The wife and the husband work out what they do in terms of work. Right? I'd ask you questions about how many of you have wives or husbands who work, and the answer would probably be many. But if I start asking things about who does the laundry, or who cooks the meals, or who makes the trash, or any of those things about home, those are probably negotiated between the two of you, and probably a long time. So the way the church asks you, how are you doing it? Well, I think you just do that and work it out. It's a practical matter. That's not the way it was at the turn of the century, the 19th to the 20th century. If a woman worked, you'd find lots of people commenting and saying, what kind of a man would allow her to do that? Or what kind of immoral woman, or whatever word you want to use to describe an immoral woman, would dare do that to her husband and her family? It brings real rebuke on all of us and the church as well. It was a moral problem. It was a theological problem. And it was not one that, at that time, the church thought was survivable. There were a lot of people who thought, this is going to destroy the family if we allow this to happen. But now we see that that didn't happen. The fears about women working are not fears that we usually have very often. So on this slide, you have a home here, and the women need it in a home here at work. And then they go back home, and there has to be a negotiated space. The women, when they get into this space over here, there are all kinds of new questions that arise. What about maternity leave? What about whether women should supervise men in these jobs. What about whether or not women should make the same amount of money as men make in this space? And basically, some of those issues are still working, some of that is still being negotiated. Again, though, this is a matter of negotiation done in the context of the people involved. Again, you don't get to hear stories of the church being involved in what Susie and John worked out for the workers, right? So, for the most part, that is going to be as well. But now we come back to, so what about this is a hot topic? And I didn't get to see the token show Tuesday night, but I understand that you were there. Women's roles were a hot topic. Is that okay to be there to hear that? Okay. Wonderful. Okay, great. So what's a hot topic? It's certainly not around submission. And in fact, this is just anecdotal. I may not be right about this, but it occurs to me that most of the time when I'm talking to a couple, actually, if I'm talking to the male, and I say something like, well, maybe you guys could come over Tuesday night, his response, for years, his response has been, if he's older, he would say, well, you'll have to check with the wife. And if he's younger, he would say, well, you'll have to ask, you know, Susie or whatever. It's become clear to me that very few men are employed in social calendar. And if you ask, well, could your children have a play date with, you know, my niece or my nephew, the man would say something, you'll have to check the law, or you'll have to check the mention her name. Now, if you go to church or they go to church, you will still hear that. The line is, women submit to men, right? But have you had an experience where that's what we're saying, but that's not what's happening at home? That it's negotiated. And you all understand that negotiation better than I do, but you know it's negotiated. And you work out what works for you. But for the most part, you know, I would still say, in church families today, it's fairly common to hear both fathers and mothers telling and encouraging their little girls to grow up and to be whatever they want to be. This is to encourage their little boys to be whatever they want to be. That's a step forward. It's a step where we're saying there are no limits, and we are encouraging the youngest among us do not create limitations. Now, it's difficult for the church in the middle here to remain free of the influences of what's going on over here and what's going on over here. Lots of negotiation, lots of negotiation. So it seems somewhat normal to me to think, why would we expect the church to be free of the conversation about what we can do there? It's not about being rebellious. It's not about being angry. In 2015, it's about we live with these three important institutions, and two of them are actively negotiating and renegotiating space. And this one is attempting to do that, but there's still quite a bit of resistance. There's some comfort for me when I think about it that way, because it's not about anything personal. It's about looking at it in the larger context of what it is. And that's what I mean when I say culture is working to our advantage here. We can say all kinds of church institutions are working through this. And if we take it in that context, and we recognize that wherever the church is on the pendulum, it's important to be there and to be supported of their own renegotiations that they may or may not be happening. It makes sense that in a world with these three institutions, had someone in the church who was speaking of, and the CEO or CFO of the company, that you might want to consider her when you're talking about your own church budget. Or if you have somebody in your church who is a well-known speaker, motivational speaker, or a well-known teacher, you might want to consider her for teaching. If you have someone who is dynamic in wanting to preach the gospel and do that, you might want to consider that happening in your church. And it might make a lot of sense, not only because of the talent, but in the context of recognizing the renegotiation that is taking place. So, for much of the 20th century, men and women participated based pretty much strictly on going back and forth about the biblical narrative. And that's an extremely important point. And we can talk about that today. And it's important to talk about that. But whether it's just assessing a biblical narrative or looking at it somewhat sociologically, the thing that I would suggest is that a really good word to use is a collage when thinking about the church today. That it's not this way or that way. It's not a dichotomy. It's not either or. But every church puts its own post-it on the collage, so to speak. And every post-it note is a little different. And that's one of the beauties of having congregational autonomy. And so when you look at it and step back, you see a collage that's filled with the negotiation, filled with a lot of grace and respect. But not a collage that's attempting to take one post-it off or throw a post-it away. Simply because it's not done the same way. The collage is important. So to get back to the question that sent me down this road to start with, why are some women interested and why are some women not so interested? One thing as an academic that I would suggest that I came to the conclusion of after going through all this is that it has a lot with how they negotiated their own space. Now, we may be able to draw other conclusions from these technologies, but that one seems pretty solid to me. That as we look at how individuals benefit from the way their particular space has been negotiated, they may be resistant to giving up that their arrangement. This is working for them. And we see other women who have renegotiated space and it's not working for them, then they may want to participate in the renegotiation. So I think it does say something. Although, like I said, I think there's a lot more work to be done there. But we need to rethink our views of how we come to hold what we believe to be true. Not to take away from the negotiations, but to simply be willing to add to them other possibilities for how you may look at something the way you do. But yes. The last thing I want to talk about is the third book that I mentioned earlier by Alan Padgett, As Christ Comes to the Church, A Biblical Understanding of Submission. This book was published in 2011. He's attempting to create another lens through which to view the biblical story on this. And he suggests that in the New Testament there are two ways the word submission is used. High blood submission, as he refers to it, is obedience to an external authority, sometimes voluntary and sometimes involuntary. But it is always hierarchical. And here we have a lot of examples of that. The government. You can be a private, you can be a lieutenant, you can be a youth specialist one, or whatever. There's a hierarchy, right? In government and in the military. In law enforcement, we see the same thing. in a company, their supervisors, their managers. But then he says there's type 2 submission in the New Testament, and that's a recognition of voluntary submission out of love and compassion. It's applied as mutual submission to all members of the body. It's internal and it's personal. Basically, Paget is submitted to what he calls isocentric ethics. And you hear that phrase a lot these days. Isocentric ethics. That is, one learns about God's expectations for submission by looking at the life of Christ. You learn about the expectations for submission by looking at the life of Christ and how Christ is given to the church. Paget suggests that from foot washing to dying on the cross, Jesus modeled submission to the kingdom of God. His unique argument is that the man-centered top-down leadership is neither biblical nor even biblical, and he writes against that evangelical argument that's often called the complementarity of the model. But it's Christ-centered. It's not concerned with issues of gender so much as how shall disciples of Jesus use their God-given power in social institutions. And he says the Christian leader is the one who takes up the role of servant, just as Jesus did. And that is the quotation I put here, is Paget's. It's a Christ-centered ethic focusing on leading through serving in God's work. Constantly call back to the service aspect of it. Unfortunately, the church too often models the culture that we impose a hierarchical model more like the military or government than the model of leadership of servant that Jesus did. Throughout the centuries, in most cultures, women have had walls built around what they can do. And yes, progress is coming, and I certainly am going to applaud the progress. And one of the things that I've noticed lately, though, is that sometimes this progress is there in some churches or one year of the pendulum, but then it stops. And the church may say, man, we've gone as far as we can go. We've allowed women to teach males, we've allowed women to pray. And I say, yeah, that's good. As long as we understand that it's a temporary stop, it's a brief respite along the way. The goal is to remove all the barriers, to remove all the walls that divide people, including women from men, and keep mutual submission as the goal. Servant leadership. In Christ-centered ethic, servant leadership never builds walls. The walls affect the numbers of kids down by at least 50% from women who are excluded. And our buildings tell that story too. You know, we use ropes. We don't see the ropes, but there's always a rope there when you're about to walk in the pulpit, right? Over the years. But, like you might, you know, throw off an area for a wedding. We all know that the boat is invisible. It's not there for men, but it's there for women. At least it has been in many places and continues to be in some. But to recognize that this is not true, that you know, both men and women remain women of God. We have absolutely no evidence in the New Testament that Jesus ever built a wall or created space. Out. And if it's not the focus there on Christ-centric leadership and Christ-centric ethics, I really think we will be much better prepared and move along and much better understanding of these destinations. So I guess to pull this all together, back to the first slide here. As we continue to study the Bible, as we continue to work together in dialogue, I would suggest a new area, not entirely new, but that we might want to look into submission in the and see, if we're beginning to see, you know, examples and patterns of how the relationship that's mission called may directly impact the kinds of ways we experience submission in the church. So I see the land. Probably going to pass on. I'm sorry about that. Again, if you have a question, I am willing to stay around, but I'm also cognizant that you have other questions to go to.